Because we have a different format today on Sabbath and so many different brethren, as Mr. Weber said, I've spent the last, I think it's 12 to 14 months now, going through a series on Daniel and living in Babylon. It's really interesting in the last week. I don't know what some of you have been doing. I know our family and our extended family, we've been going through, rummaging through the things we don't need, don't want, and getting rid of what whatever that may be. And I came across, lo and behold, the last time I did this series, which was almost 25 years ago. So I think what I'll do is I'll just play a tape of this message. No, I'm kidding. It was really interesting to see. My biggest punishment would be to listen to those tapes 25 years ago. So the purpose, as we live in a type of Babylon, and indeed the world around us is that type of a system, both covertly and overtly, how do we live? How do we practice our faith? Daniel is an excellent, but as we will see, surely not perfect example. He was in Babylon almost completely alone. Brought there as a teenager, he was carted off from home, Jerusalem, for exile of some 70 years. Let's do a real quick recap. The book of Daniel is interesting in that one of the its original aspects is it's written in two different languages. In chapter 2 through this chapter 7, it is written in Aramaic. The rest is in Hebrew. Daniel, as a reminder, and his three cohorts, if you remember their names, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego were their Babylon names. They were taken captive by old Nebuchadnezzar of Babylon in approximately 586 BC. And the king, in the first chapter, put them on a special diet, which Daniel and his friends didn't believe they could eat. They prayed, God protected them, and the king promoted them. In chapter 2, Nebuchadnezzar has a dream. He needs analysis, threatens everybody in the kingdom because they can't interpret his dream, this threat of death. And sure enough, Daniel analyzes it, and it's the metal figure with the gold head. In chapter 3, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego tested on their worship and wound up in the fiery furnace. And a very strange and unique visitor meets them in the furnace and protects them. Chapter 4, another dream. Nebuchadnezzar's tree and the pride that he has leads him to the heart of a beast. And Daniel assists there as well. In chapter 5, there's a new king, Belshazzar. He's the writing on the wall guy, if you remember him. Daniel again interprets, and Daniel is promoted. In chapter 6, the last one we covered, the Medo-Persian Empire conquers Babylon. There's a new king in town named Darius. Daniel is tested. Will he bow the knee to this king? And we know that from the story of the lion's den and how, again, Daniel was protected. After chapter 6, the book of Daniel in his personal life is pretty much over. We don't hear much about the day-to-day. The remaining chapters, though they are very different, are not those reflections of his personal life. In fact, they are very different. Chapters 7 through 12, as we'll see, are often seen as prophetic, and by many people are therefore seen as more important. They are not. They are equally as important. Although it has beasts and images and power, they've got some lessons to learn because of this importance. In fact, I think chapter 7, we're going to try and explore a very hidden focus. So for the title of Daniel chapter 7, I picked Daniel 7. Catchy, huh? Just rolls off the tongue, doesn't it? No, I add a little bit. The title of this message is Daniel 7, Son of Man, subtitled, and I can't, Mr. Fish can't unmute everybody for this because I'd like your reaction. It's Daniel, Son of Man, subtitled, Lions and Leopards and Bears. I want you to please take a piece of paper, if you would, please. We're going to make a church chart, a prophetic church chart. I need you to take a piece of paper 3 feet by 5 feet. I'll wait. Long enough. Now, take a small piece of paper. Across the header, I want you to write Daniel 2 on the left side, upper left. And to the right, next header, Daniel chapter 7. Under Daniel 2, I want you to write this in order, one below the other. This, if you remember, is the image of gold from Daniel chapter 2. Gold, silver, bronze, iron, and then rock slash stone. Under the header of Daniel 7, that's what we're going to go through, and you'll see the comparison. So let's begin in chapter 7, beginning in verse 1 of Daniel. In the first year of Belshazzar, king of Babylon, Daniel had a dream and visions of his head while on his bed. Then he wrote down the dream, telling the main facts. Now, we're already told that Daniel has gone back a few years to Belshazzar. He's the writing on the wall guy, if you remember him. And Daniel, the dream interpreter, irony of ironies, he has a dream. And this dominates the rest of the book, are the dreams, images, and visions. And we will see that Daniel has a near nightmare. In his head, he sees a vision. And so we'll see that he has his tablet and his writing pen with him. I'm sure many of you have a writing pen and tablet by your bedstead. I have one. I've had one for years. And it's really to record things after you wake up. And this was part of a management course I had long ago. They said, put a piece of paper and a writing instrument next to your bed. When you wake up, write down the first thing that comes into your mind from a possible dream. And you can remember it and relate to it later. Well, I did that. So I have this pen and pad, and after waking up, I once wrote down, quote, tall man with ice cream cone chased my Mickey Mouse, unquote. That's the last time I wrote anything down. But on your sheet, I want you to write under Daniel 2, this golden image, the parallels that we read in Daniel 7. It's also, as a side reference for further study, Revelation 13 and Revelation 17 relate to these images. So let's read verse 2. Daniel spoke, saying, I saw in my vision by night, and behold, the four winds of heaven were stirring up the great sea, and four great beasts came up from the sea, each different from the other. The first was like a lion, and had eagle's wings. I watched till its wings were plucked off, and it was lifted up from the earth and made to stand on 2 feet like a man. And in fact, a man's heart was given to it. This is interesting all by itself, these four beasts. He switches, you'll notice, from the third person in the first verse, to first person in these verses, and it'll switch back and forth throughout the chapter. When he says, I saw, you'll see in whatever translation you may have, I saw, I watched, I looked. And you're going to see it 9 times, the same verb used in 8 different verses. It could be watching, observing, it can be looking. And so these four winds that we see in verse 2, anciently, were meaning of what? The whole earth. If you recall, there were the four corners of the earth. We're represented now by the four compass points. There's the four seasons. Remember the four seasons, the band. No, I meant the four seasons of the weather. The four seas or the oceans of the world known at that time. The four oceans at that time were the Med, the Dead, the Red, and the Sea of Galilee. Mediterranean, the Dead Sea, the Red Sea, and the Sea of Galilee. So he's talking about from the four winds, it is a huge swath of the earth. The great beasts come out of the sea. This has got to be a terrifying vision. The seas we know can mean people. And again, I refer you back to Revelation chapter 13. This would scare most people if you had a dream like that. And Daniel can somewhat see, and he's writing it down as he sees that. It's a vision. He sees these four animals. And he is the teller of dreams. Remember this. This is one of the ironies of the book of Daniel chapter 7. This is an irony. Now he has his own dream. Twice he interpreted Nebuchadnezzar and once Belshazzar's vision of the handwriting on the wall. So we pick up the theme again in verse 5. And suddenly another beast, second like a bear, it was raised up on one side and had 3 ribs in its mouth and between its teeth. And they said thus to it, arise, devour much flesh. Verse 6, after this, I looked and there was another like a leopard, which had on its back 4 wings of a bird. The beast also had 4 heads and dominion was given to it. After this, I saw in the night visions and behold, a 4th beast, dreadful and terrible, exceedingly strong. It had huge iron teeth. It has devouring, breaking into pieces and trampling the residue with its feet. It was different from all the beasts that were before it. And it had 10 horns. I was considering the horns. There was another horn, a little one, coming up among them, before whom 3 of the first horns were plucked out by the roots. And there, in this horn, were eyes like the eyes of a man, and a mouth speaking pompous words. These 4 kingdoms parallel the 4 metal kingdoms of Daniel 2. The lion with eagle wings, he is the king of beasts. The eagle is the king of birds. He stands upright, even like a man. In fact, he is given the heart of a man. This is a near direct reference to Daniel in the chapter where Nebuchadnezzar becomes a beast and his heart is changed. The bear is on its side, or another side, with three ribs in its mouth. The leopard with four wings and four heads. This has got to be some dream. So lions, and leopards, and bears, and a terrible, terrible beast, unnamed. The scene was profound. Again, it was terrifying. This fourth beast, its destructiveness with its ten horns, its pompous little horn. What possibly could this mean? Well, you know, as you've been able to see in the image from Daniel 2, and if you've been writing them down, they parallel the metals. So what does this all mean? You know what this means. So good. So we're done. So nice seeing you. Let's have coffee if we know what this means. Indeed, this subject occupies so much of our booklets and papers and so many of the articles that have been written. It's also on every prophetic website, ours and hundreds of other groups. This is well-known information, all because of chapter 2 in the image, the gold, the silver, the bronze, the iron, and the clay, and the stone kingdom. We know, just as we do here, the first beast is Babylon. In the British Museum, and I know many of you have been there, Becky and I were there years ago, on loan from the museum in Berlin is the image of a lion. And it was part, as I recall, the Ishtar Gate. So Daniel 2 was Babylon. So in chapter 7, it also, the first beast is Babylon. The confirmation is Daniel 4 with the change of his heart. The second is the dual regency. The second beast is Medo-Persia with its two sides. The three ribs in its mouth are thought to be the three conquering countries by Medo-Persia of Lydia, Babylon before it, and Egypt, and all were conquered in less than a decade. The third kingdom, the third beast, is Greece. It has four wings. Alexander the Great conquered, again, huge land masses of the known area, and he did it again in a very short time. Alexander died very young, and the four heads result are the four kings that followed and that Alexander left were his four generals, Cassander, Lysimachus, Seleucus, and Ptolemy. Those were his four generals, and those divided up his kingdom. The fourth is undescribed, this beast. It's a non-type. It really is hard, but has been identified for centuries as the ongoing kingdom of Rome. Its ten horns and the pompous voice are its leaders of 10 countries or entities, and at times various religious leaders. This picture is an odd scene. Can you imagine the horn that Daniel sees in the night vision? A horn that has eyes, and if that weren't crazy enough, this horn has eyes and it talks. And the things that it says are outrageous. Ugh. So again, we can only imagine what poor Daniel saw. But you are aware of this. You understand it. But as we will see, Daniel was troubled. Daniel, remember, at the time of this writing, Daniel had seen and lived among two of the four beasts, Babylon and currently under Medo-Persia. He was living in the time of the second. But for some reason, this troubles him. And then dramatically, as we read this story, this successive story of vision, the scene changes dramatically. The physical kingdoms, the physical earthly kingdoms are changed. They are left behind in a change to a new setting, and it goes directly up to heaven. The scene in heaven, we will read now in verses 9 through 11 of Daniel 7. And I want you to listen to this because this is some of the most intriguing and fascinating historically verses in all the Bible and historical religious literature. Chapter 9. I watched till thrones were set in place, and the Ancient of Days was seated. His garment was white as snow, and the hair of his head was like pure wool. His throne was a fiery flame, its wheels a burning fire. A fire stream issued and came forth from before him. A thousand thousands ministered to him. 10,000 times 10,000 stood before him. The court was seated. The books were opened. And I watched, Then because of the sound of the pompous words which the horn was speaking. This is simultaneously to watching the heavenly council. I watched till the beast was slain, its body destroyed, given to the burning flame. And as for the rest of the beast, they had their dominion taken away, yet their lives were prolonged for a season and a time. Verse 13, I was watching in the night visions, and behold, one like the Son of Man coming with the clouds of heaven. He came to the Ancient of Days. They brought him near before him. They brought the Son of Man close to the Ancient of Days. Then to him, the Son of Man, was given dominion and glory and a kingdom, that all peoples and nations and languages would serve him. His dominion is an everlasting dominion, which shall not pass away, and his kingdom, this the one which shall not be destroyed. What a change in both locale and subject and the nature. It is completely different. It's of courts and seats. In the Ancient of Days, Son of Man, some of the most enigmatic entities in all the Bible are in this chapter. And it has set up the imagination of people for hundreds and thousands of years and have written down them. Even Isaac Newton, Sir Isaac Newton, the physicist, astronomer, mathematician, wrote an entire commentary on the book of Daniel. He was so compelled by this book and especially this chapter. It says there is a divine council in heaven. It is ruled by the Ancient of Days. The Ancient of Days, by the vast majority of scholars, and we would agree, identify the Ancient of Days as God the Father. In verses 13 and 14, the very interesting phrase, Son of Man, or like one like the Son of Man, this cloud rider who ascends through heaven on clouds, who is given rulership, glory, and an everlasting kingdom. Like a fifth kingdom, a fifth kingdom. Here is again one of the most fascinating sets of verses in all the Bible. It formed the basis for the next 400 to 500 years into the Second Temple of Judaism when Jesus arrived on the scene. Who was this Son of Man? Who could he possibly be? He seemed to be somewhat of a messianic figure. This cloud rider was very important, and he and the Father seemed to be in special league together. They had a very special relationship. He again rides the clouds. He is a man, but not a man, as he approaches God the Father, the Ancient of Days. What relationship does he have with the Ancient of Days? Well, we know him definitively as Jesus Christ. One of the most important sections in the entire Bible is this concept of the Son of Man. Interestingly, when we go to the New Testament, Jesus self-identifies himself as the Son of Man, some 80 times, almost 80 times in the New Testament, he references himself as the Son of Man. What is strange is that no one else calls him the Son of Man in the New Testament. You need not turn there, but in Matthew 6, verse 13, Jesus asks the question, who do men say that I, the Son of Man, am? Turn with me, if you would, to Matthew chapter 26, however, where we have a fascinating exchange at the end of Jesus' earthly life. Something we read not too long ago, or words to it, if you did read during Passover season, in Matthew chapter 26, and we're going to pick up the story in verse 62. Now keep in mind here that Jesus is before the high priest, and he's being questioned. He's being interrogated by the chief priests. And beginning in verse 62, I want you to listen to the interchange, because it is fascinating. Now keep in mind, this is 400 to 500 years after the concept of Daniel 7, chapter 7, and the Son of Man. Verse 62, and the high priest arose and said to him, Jesus, do you answer nothing? What is it these men testify against you? But Jesus kept silent. He says, and the high priest answered and said to him, I put you under oath by the living God. Tell us if you are the Christ, the Son of God. And this is one of the few things, if you have a red letter Bible, this is in a sea of black. This is in red, how Jesus responds. Of all the responses he could give, listen to these words. Jesus said to him, it is as you said. Nevertheless, I say to you, hereafter you will see the Son of Man sitting at the right hand of the power and coming on the clouds of heaven. And look at the reaction. The high priest tore his clothes, saying, he has spoken blasphemy. What further need do we have of witnesses? Look, now you have heard his blasphemy. What do you think? What was the blasphemy? That he was the Son of Man figure referenced in Daniel. The Pharisees, the Sadducees, the elders of Israel knew exactly what he's referring to. He took the place of that man, that Son of Man, in the book of Daniel. And it's a throne room. It's a setting scene of the court. And Jesus says, I am sitting down next to God the Father. I am that Son of Man. This is so important. There were many sons of God. There were many physical men that claimed they were the Messiah. But Daniel 7:14 and Matthew chapter 26 and other verses in the New Testament link inexorably together that Jesus is the Son of Man. It is he who approaches the Ancient of Days in the clouds of heaven in Daniel 7. This Son of Man, Jesus Christ, was to have a kingdom and reign over all the earth, over all the peoples, millions upon hundreds of millions. He would subdue all nations. This concept, I'll turn back to Daniel 7 if you would. This concept of the duality of the Godhead, we call it the binitarian construct, which we believe was the major theological earthquake in later Judaism known as the two powers of heaven. And this is the verse, or these are the verses, especially verses 7, 14, 13, and 14, that are used to interpret it. It was so extant as a belief that there were two powers in heaven, two entities, God the Father and another entity, that by the first century, it was a major reason why Jesus was so readily accepted as divine, that God, through Christ's kingdom, the last of the kingdoms, he is the last true king and savior, worshiped by millions. And we know that only God can man worship. And yet, we read on in chapter 7, verse 15. Turn there, please. And yet, read this statement by Daniel. Verse 15, I, Daniel, was grieved in my spirit, within my body. The visions of my head, they troubled me. He was troubled. He said, I came near to one of those who stood by and asked him the truth of this. That is such a fascinating set of verses. Of all that he had seen, of all that Daniel had been shown, obviously it was from God. And he now references a being, more than likely an angel standing by him. He knows this is from God. He is troubled. He uses an interesting phrase called, tell me the truth of it all. Please tell me the truth of it all. The truth of all this. It's interesting that he would use this phrase. In some of the translations you may have in front of you, it may say, please show me the exact meaning. Show me the exact interpretation. The true interpretation. Could it have been the question, was he troubled because of the fate of God's saints? Did that trouble him? Was it the first, the second, the third, the fourth beast? The scene in the heavenly court? The Son of Man? What was it that he wanted? The bottom line is, we don't know. He isn't explicit, but he wanted more information. And so this angel responds. Verse 16, he says, tell me the interpretation of these things. Verse 17, those great beasts, this is the angel speaking now, so he told me, the great beasts which are four kings or kingdoms, which shall arise out of the earth. But the saints of the Most High shall receive the kingdom, possess the kingdom forever, even forever and ever. Daniel's troubled. He wants an answer to these questions. And the angel gives him the shortest of answers. No detail. This is what it means. It's basically the same words of the vision in capsule form. No detailed explanation. No names. He gives him this very short overview. He says the beasts are indeed four kingdoms. Well, even we knew that. He then says, and God's people, they will be saved. They will be saved. The Ancient of Days, the Son of Man, though they're not mentioned, God's saints will be preserved. What's interesting is he does use the phrase, a different phrase in these verses, in verse 18. He uses the phrase Most High, the saints of the Most High, El Elyon. It's very interesting. It's called a majesty of plurality in Hebrew. It almost means that there's more than one of a Godhead. We would interpret that rightly in saying it is this plurality of the Godhead in two people, the Ancient of Days and the Son of Man. But the angel does not mention Babylon, Persia, Greece. He doesn't mention any of that. He doesn't mention Nebuchadnezzar. He doesn't mention Cyrus. He doesn't mention Belshazzar. It's vague at best. What's obvious is the angel felt that this was sufficient. This is what you need to know. That's it. There's no further explanation. What's fascinating is what goes after the next verses, verse 19. Daniel is not satisfied. Verse 19, then I wished to know the truth about the fourth beast, which was different from all the others. Different it was. It was hard to describe. It was exceedingly dreadful, with its teeth of iron, its nails of bronze, which devoured broken pieces, trampled the residue with its feet, and the 10 horns that were on its head, and the other horn which came up, before which 3 fell, namely that horn which had eyes and a mouth, which spoke pompous words, whose appearance was greater than his fellows. This is Daniel saying all this. I want to know more. I want to know the truth. I wanted to have details. I mean, Daniel's basically saying to the angel, what up with that? What is this all about? Who and what is this thing? He's not satisfied. It's interesting what Daniel doesn't ask about. He doesn't ask regarding the judgment and the finality. He doesn't ask about who the Ancient of Days is. He doesn't even ask who the Son of Man is. That beast seemed to trouble him. Why? Why did it trouble him? Surely Daniel, here's this irony in Daniel 7, the interpreter of dreams, surely Daniel could see the parallel with Daniel chapter 2. We can. We can see at least 3 kingdoms clearly through history. And the fourth, we have a pretty good idea what it is. We also are seeing in retrospect who they were actually. So we need to maybe give Daniel a break. He didn't see them as the image of the 4 metals in Daniel 2. And so in verse 19 and 20, he asks for truth. He asks for certainty. Yet seemingly, he either did not understand or it wasn't clear. So the vision continues now with more detail. So, verse 21, here's that word again. I was watching, and the same horn was making war with the saints against the saints and prevailing against them, the saints, until the Ancient of Days came, and judgment was made in favor of the saints of the Most High. There's that phrase again. And the time came for the saints to possess the kingdom. He watches. The last beast, especially the pompous little horn, is now prevailing against God's people. This also seems to maybe bother him. The Ancient of Day moves. Judgment is made. And that's that courtroom scene where the chairs are assembled. That's the courtroom scene. The angel speaks, and now the angel explains further. Thus he said, this is the being standing next to him, one of those. Verse 23, thus he said, the fourth beast shall be a fourth kingdom on the earth, which shall be different from all the other kingdoms, shall devour the whole earth, trample it, and break it in pieces. The 10 horns are 10 kings. Who shall arise from this kingdom? And another shall arise after them. And he shall be different from the first ones. And he shall subdue 3 kings. He shall speak pompous words against the Most High, shall persecute the saints of the Most High, and shall intend to change times and law. Then the saints shall be given into his hand for a time, times, and half a time. Now, he's reiterated a lot of what we've known, but he goes on. The court shall be seated. They shall take away his dominion to consume and destroy it forever. Then the kingdom and dominion and the greatness of the kingdoms under the whole heaven shall be given to the people who, There's that phrase, the saints of the Most High. His kingdom is an everlasting kingdom, and all dominion shall serve and obey him. The angel has just gone into a recounting of what we've heard before. He gives some more detail, but not a whole lot. He again reiterates this, what this fourth kingdom will do. It will devour the entire earth. It will trample and break it in pieces. There will be 10 horns, 10 kings. This pompous little horn. It says these 10 kings, who from the Hebrew, by the way, tend to be contemporaneous rather than consecutive, but that's another time for another story and another story for another day. He talks about these 10 kings, the little horn, they shall be judged and they shall be destroyed. In verse 25, the second half, it says he will seek to change times and laws. If we interpret this fourth beast as the empire of Rome and its legions and its successor kingdoms, we could easily say that Rome, through its religious aspects, changed Sabbath to Sunday or the calendar. But we see all this in retrospect. None of this detail is given to Daniel. No specificity whatsoever. So what we see from the back mirror, the rear view mirror of history, which Daniel did not have. It's interesting. We're familiar with the Seventh-day Adventists and a lot of the reference material for both the book of Daniel and the book of Revelation is built on these verses in the book of Daniel and Revelation. They have more commentaries, I think, than any other denomination. I have a number. I know that many other ministers have these as well. Their work is voluminous. It has occupied nearly all they do. In fact, chapter 7 and chapter 8, they feel is so important, along with all the other historical background they've given you. They feel 7 and 8 are so important, they form what they call the heart and soul of their doctrine of the investigative judgment. We too wait for this fulfillment, for the 10 toes, the 10 horns, the pompous one. Speculation is rife. It's always been rife. Every pope, including Luther, Martin Luther's Leo X, was the Antichrist. The pope is the ongoing favorite. But it is still unknown, but he's a pretty good candidate. But there have been failed prophecies, dozens and dozens of failed predictions, horrifically wrong prognostications, which have cost people their faith. They were just plain wrong. So once again, we need to give Daniel a little bit of a break. It is very clear. Prophecy is important. It is vitally important. We must, interestingly enough, watch, just as Daniel did in Daniel 7. And we must also pray. But the details are often elusive. But there's also another factor. Now, this has really nothing to do with the message, but it is poignant. I had a recent birthday. If you didn't send me a present, there's still time. I'll give you my address later. So I'm a little bit older. My sister had sent me a card a while back, and it was very nice, and it's all it was. It was this nice card, and it said, "Forget the past. You can't change it. Forget the future. You can't predict it. And forget the present, because I didn't get you one." And that's my sister's humor. But there's a lot of truth in that. The future, you can't predict it. Though men will try, they'll do it to detail. So what I'm about to reveal to you, as I have to a few, is the theory of inverse proportionality constant as it relates to the return of Jesus Christ. It is near foolproof. It has been tested empirically hundreds of times. It states a person's age minus the Pauli exclusion principle is the closer Christ's return is. Note, please, that this model is described as a quantum nonlinear Schrödinger equation. I'm kidding about all that. What it says is, it seems that the older that we get, the closer it is to Christ's return. Why is that? It always is that way. The older we think we are, we think it has to be close to the end. And it may be. But is that important, what we think? How about Daniel? I believe in many ways, he did not know, and we do not know. We do not know the exact hour or the exact time. We think sometimes it is always prophecy, and indeed prophecy is important. But But I think it's about a question here of emphasis in Daniel 7. Daniel asked repeatedly for more information, for more details. Well, I want to know what the truth is. I want exactness. What was the result? Let's read the result in verse 28, the end of this chapter. This is the end of the account, writes Daniel. As for me, Daniel, my thoughts greatly troubled me. My countenance changed, but I kept the matter in my heart. His head, his heart, even his face, his countenance, it changed. He was troubled, and he kept quiet about it. He told no one until he wrote this book, this chapter. As we will see as we go through the rest of the book of Daniel, Daniel's faith was very, very strong. But he was also strong enough to admit that he didn't know everything. His knowledge wasn't perfect. We can see in this chapter he asked over and over and over again. Daniel 7 is a critical chapter to world history and to prophecy. But it's also, this specific chapter is a chapter of great irony. Daniel gave detailed analysis of other people's dreams, yet he was not given the same. Why? We just aren't told, and that should be good enough. It should also teach us something. We have been given far more information than Daniel had. We know exactly who the image of Daniel 2 was, the four metals. We know exactly who these kingdoms are pretty well, even the fourth kingdom in Daniel chapter 7. We have far more than Daniel ever had. And yet, for some strange, odd reason, we want to know even more details. We want perfection. We want the exact year, the exact month. We want the exact day. Look at the web. It is rife with speculation. They are false prophecies. So this is a chapter of irony. In the midst of lions and leopards and bears, of lions, leopards, and bears, and the terrible beast, Daniel 7 is not about so much what happens, but more importantly, who saves God's people. If we long to know what these four beasts are, should we not more so, especially during this time between Passover and Pentecost, understand it is who saves God's people? The what's are important. What beast is what? What the toes mean? What the horns mean? But more importantly is what happens as to who. This scene in heaven of Daniel 7, where Jesus Christ and the Father meet, and Christ is made king and given an everlasting kingdom. In the midst of the vision of earthly kingdoms and absolute chaos and destruction and death, massive death, the world over with this terrible beast, Daniel is given a glimpse, and it bothers him horribly. But he also sees of Christ as the Son of Man receiving the kingdom forever. It is similar to Passover season and the wave sheaf offering, where Jesus, under the wave sheaf, ascends to God on that Sunday to be reunited with God after his physical life. After triumphing over death at Passover, he ascends as victor, as triumphant victor to God the Father. After rescuing God's people at the end here in Daniel 7, he again ascends to be given all power, dominion, and authority, and he sits with God. Jesus Christ and the Father are reunited forever with the saints of the Most High. We can agree that we indeed live in Babylon. We see it around us all the time. As we heard in the opening prayer, and has been on the news every minute of every day, 24/7, for many, many weeks, we are under the prayerfully and hopefully trailing curve of a plague. In my humble opinion, this is just my opinion, this has done many things. Most importantly, not exclusively, it has shown human nature. It has shown some wonderful examples of how human beings come to the rescue of other human beings. And that's wonderful. Their ability to overcome. But it has also shown absolute and utter confusion and bitter divide, and mankind's utter inability to control himself. to act in a unified nature. We have seen it all. But by the same token, this is not the end. It is severe. The numbers are staggering. And we can compare it with this epidemic or that flu. I got all that. This is bad. But this plague is not the end. But it could very well possibly be a dress rehearsal. It is a glimpse, a small, tiny window of what that can be expected. Maybe not in 5 years or 10 years, I have no idea. And you know what? No one else does. And anybody who tells you that they do know is wrong. If Christ didn't know on his earthly visit, and we are not told explicitly, and I've seen the websites, and I've seen the charts, and I've seen the prognostications as you have, and they are wrong because they were wrong in the past. But it is nonetheless a glimpse. It's a glimpse of when the end comes, it will be filled with lions and leopards and bears and terrible, terrible beasts. There will be no Zoom. You will not have service because there will be no internet. There will be no cars. There will be no gas to be had. There'll be no 7-Eleven, no Trader Joe's. I know that's enough to shock anybody into the next life. There'll be none of that. So we are seeing, if nothing else, a glimpse. But among all that chaos, Daniel 7 tells us, whereas we may not know the prophecies perfectly, this we do know, is that the Son of Man will appear. There will be the Son of Man. In the midst of the chaos, Daniel 7 tells us, Jesus Christ and God the Father are there. These days that we celebrate between Passover and the days of unleavened bread, and Pentecost, these days picture part of that plan. So Daniel is as we are. In the midst of tragedy, in the midst of confusion, we have this hope. It really depends on Daniel 7, what we will focus and concentrate on. What is it about Daniel 7, I think, that is so poignant, is that future is thrust upon us. Hope in the few verses that are given with the Son of Man and the Ancient of Days, the court in heaven. What is our focus? The prophecies are important. But during these unique days where we are so-called confined, prison is confinement. But yet we call this a confinement. I got it. We've got the same restrictions you do. But what lessons can we learn? What are we taking away from this? Let me ask you, brethren, if I had told you, I won't say prophesied, but what if I had told you 6 months ago at the last feast, let's say somebody else said, I don't want it to be me. If someone had stood up at the feast and said, in 6 months, you will be confined to your homes. There will be no church services. You'll experience Passover as you've never experienced it. You'll be on Zoom, if anything. And everyone would say, What's a Zoom? Passover will be separately. There will be massive unemployment. Businesses will fail. Your work life will be disrupted to a degree that you have never experienced before. There is a plague, a virus, 1 million U.S. cases, 78,000 dead in the United States alone, and 250,000 around the world. If you'd have been told that 6 months ago, what would you have thought? You'd have thought that person was out of their mind. And you didn't hear that 6 months ago. These things happen the way they happen for the reasons we don't understand. But what would you have thought? Better yet, question, what would you have done? I would suggest a few things that we are doing and that we should be doing. And Daniel 7 tells us this. We understand exactly what we don't know. We have to, as it says in one very famous movie, the lead hero says, a man's got to learn to know his own limitations, that we don't have perfect knowledge. We are better than Daniel? We are more gifted than Daniel? I don't think so. We have the benefit of history of hindsight and not much more. And so we see this as a time for introspection. What would you have done if you knew in 6 months this would happen? I would suggest to you that you would pray more often. Pray as we did in the opening prayer. Pray as we did as a country this week, that you would pray more often, privately and collectively, that you would use this time to read your Bible more often, not less. People are wondering what to do. Yeah, streaming is at an all-time high, but so should reading our Bibles. To call, communicate with loved ones. See them when and if you can. Get together as you're allowed to, and as much as you can, obey the restrictions for your local area. What would you have done if you knew 6 months ago this would happen? What will you do now? I think Daniel 7 allows us an idea, because this is a test. Things like this are, if nothing else, a test of what we will do. It's practice. This isn't the end. I doubt that it's even the lead up to the end. I doubt that we can even imagine, comprehend, understand what the end will be like. So maybe God is giving us a small, tiny glimpse of what we will see. He also may be asking us what we will do. What are our priorities? So fill your life with the right priorities. Understand and appreciate the protection that God gives us. This is a test.